This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Federal Parliament sits today for the first time since the Queen's death with a whole day dedicated to condolence speeches. Many most likely will pay tribute to the Queen's service during her 70-year reign and 16 visits to Australia. But for Parliament's Indigenous members, it's complex. Many say while it's important to respect the late monarch, the pain of colonisation must be acknowledged. From Parliament House, here's Tom Lowry.
Linda Burney says growing up, the Queen had a remarkable presence in her childhood.
I grew up in a household where her picture was collected out of newspapers.
The Minister for Indigenous Australians will today join other MPs from across the Parliament in speaking on the Queen's life. Today's sitting of Parliament will be dedicated solely to condolences for the Queen, with most MPs making five-minute speeches. Linda Burney says she feels it is important to take part.
This is about a respectful display to a woman that had a life of service for 70 years. But you cannot ignore the reality of Aboriginal people in Australia over those 70 years. And of course, it was the British that colonised Australia, and that's also part of the story.
Her colleague, Assistant Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malandiri McCarthy, also plans on speaking. Senator McCarthy says it's been a fortnight of deep thought and reflection.
We talk about the importance of the beginnings of Australia in terms of non-Indigenous involvement in this country, and the monarchy was very much and still is very much front and centre of that. So there's been very mixed emotions, but I have no doubt that, you know, the Queen's presence on the world stage to women, to mothers, to grandmothers was constant and was a presence to all people.
Green Senator Dorinda Cox says she's been working on her speech since the Queen's passing. She says it's important to honour the Queen's contribution to public life, but also push for change.
There is a broader conversation and there is a broader movement of people, particularly Indigenous people across the world, who are clearly of the opinion that this is now a time for us to think about what we represent as Commonwealth countries, and the broader conversation in relation to a treaty and republic.
Labor Senator Patrick Dodson is in New York at the UN General Assembly, so won't be in Parliament today. He says he can understand why many Indigenous Australians have found the past fortnight difficult, but he says the Queen does deserve a level of respect as a human being and a leader too.
Tom Lowry. And as Tom just mentioned, Patrick Dodson is at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, and he'll join Patricia Cavellis after 7:30. Since the Queen's death, the Prime Minister's shut down questions about whether Australia should become a republic. With the public day of mourning now over, the Australian Republican Movement will relaunch its campaign today for Australia to split from the monarchy. But the number of people who'd say yes to that right now is a minority, as Isabel Rowe reports.
Almost 2 weeks after Her Majesty's death, the nation stopped for an official day of mourning and a memorial service in Canberra. Today, the CEO of the Australian Republican Movement, Sandy Beyer, is back to business.
We've respectfully observed the mourning period for Queen Elizabeth, and it was quite appropriate that we did acknowledge her service, but we now have a king that we didn't choose as Australians. A king that has nowhere near the level of support that his mother had, and someone who's not fit to be Australia's head of state.
Sandy Beyer will lead the campaign to push for an Australian head of state with the support of the federal government, which has promised to hold a referendum on the matter if it's re-elected.
And so we're really looking forward to having that conversation over the next couple of years so that we can have a proposal that's put to a referendum that has the best possible chance of success.
Recent polling suggests campaigners have their work cut out for them. The latest Guardian Essential poll conducted following the Queen's death showed 43% support for becoming a republic. Another poll conducted by Resolve showed 46% support the change. Sandy Beyer isn't fazed.
This is likely to be the high watermark for the monarchy in Australia. And so the real test will be in the years to come.
The movement will push for King Charles to be replaced by an Australian head of state, someone who is elected in a national ballot from a short list of candidates. David Hill, a former managing director of the ABC and an author on Australia's relationship with the monarchy, believes Australians will need to be assured that not too much will change.
Nobody wants to see a change in our political system. We just want to see a change where Australians appoint their own head of state. The Queen was so effective and so popular. She's left the monarchy in the strongest possible state, and King Charles will benefit from it. And I think the opportunity for a republic's going to be far greater a little while down the track than it is today.
In 3 or 4 years, for example, when the
referendum... Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Look, I think it's fair to say Australians have never warmed to Charles anywhere near like they have his mother.
Both polls conducted since the Queen's death suggested support for a republic was highest among Victorians.
Isabel Rowe, you're listening to AM and it's 16 past 7. The cyber attack on Optus, compromising the data of millions of customers, raises the question of how well companies are prepared to confront online crooks and potential ransom demands. While Optus says there's been no ransom demand yet, that costly scenario is on the rise, with companies under constant pressure to protect their data and to stay ahead of cyber villains. For more about this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, how common are cyber attacks and do they always end in ransom demands?
Well, good morning, Sabra. I've asked Optus if this is a ransomware attack. I've been told there's been no ransom demand so far, but that investigations are continuing into what could be one of the biggest cyber attacks in Australian history. In the meantime, Optus's 11 million customers have been told to be extra vigilant about suspicious calls, texts or emails, given that their personal information might have been hijacked. Things like dates of birth, passport numbers, driver's licences. What we do know is that the attack appears to have come from overseas. But yes, ransomware is a growing risk. That's where sophisticated hackers hijack data and then demand massive payments for it to be released. There have been cases where companies have actually paid up. Last year, Colonial Pipeline in the United States handed over more than $4 million US dollars to resume business. The cybersecurity company Cohesity has surveyed 500 IT leaders in Australia and New Zealand. 69% think the ransomware risk has increased over the past year. 46% said their companies had been ransomware victims over the past 6 months. I spoke with Brian Spanswick, Chief Information Officer at Cohesity, who says ransomware and cyber attacks are here to stay and that companies are racing to keep up with the cyber crooks.
Well, it's getting a lot more prevalent for sure. And so what we've seen historically is that attackers have been focused on holding a company ransom, which means that they've hijacked the primary systems and they probably have also compromised the backups. And they're holding that ransom from a perspective of, if you want to conduct business, you've got to pay the ransom to be able to get those systems back online.
How common is it now that companies are actually paying the ransom to get their data back?
So I think you're seeing it less and less. If you think about situations like Colonial Pipeline, they paid the ransom and it took them a substantial amount of time to get their business processes back online. So I think what you're seeing is that organizations are starting to understand that their ability to recover the business process is the best combat against a ransomware attack.
But by paying a ransom, isn't that encouraging more ransomware attacks?
It does. And going beyond that, the impact of a ransomware attack goes beyond just paying the ransom. So when you think about the impact that a ransomware attack has on customer confidence, these things are a lot more expensive than the ransom payments.
Are law enforcement agencies or intelligence agencies sophisticated enough in keeping up with the ransomware attackers?
Well, it's not their responsibility to stop those ransomware attacks. It's the organization's responsibility. In addition, organizations should be looking at, when breached, how do we minimize the impact? Things like encrypting the data and then being able to recover your core systems from the last known good backup really takes a lot of the weight out of the hands of the attacker.
That's Brian Spanswick, and he's the Chief Information Officer at the cybersecurity firm Cohesity, and he was speaking with Peter Ryan. Russians are fleeing the country to avoid military service after the Kremlin announced it'll send thousands of reservists to fight in Ukraine. Already, long queues have formed at land borders and flights have sold out as men of fighting age try to avoid being drafted. On the world stage, Moscow's defended its actions despite widespread condemnation at the United Nations General Assembly. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
One by one, Russians fearing a war arrived at Istanbul Airport. Georgi has come with his wife and two children. He doesn't want us to use his last name. This was supposed to be a holiday, but he doesn't know if he'll ever return to his homeland.
Of course, I am horrified I could be drafted, and I feel like everything inside me is replaced by panic. I calmed down, and when I thought about what to do, I started panicking again. I am scared and fearful because I don't know what will happen next.
The cost of flights from Moscow to nearby countries soared, and in some cases sold out. Some left by car, with long queues forming at Russia's border crossing to neighbouring Georgia. Georgi says the announcement 300,000 reservists will be called upon to fight in Ukraine has terrified many.
The state has been repressing protesters, but going to Ukraine for war is nonsense. It's better to leave Russia than stay there.
The Kremlin says reports of an exodus are exaggerated, and already 10,000 volunteers have signed up to fight. Another woman who wished to remain anonymous spoke to the ABC at Istanbul Airport. She fled and says she knows many who have been called upon to fight.
We are in shock. We are very worried. This is a nightmare for us. Many people that I know received their draft order. The guy sitting next to me on the plane was running from the draft. He didn't know where he will go next or where he'll end up. Many people, of course, will suffer.
Discussion about the war in Ukraine continues to dominate talks at the United Nations General Assembly. The US has called on the world to hold the country to account. There's been widespread condemnation, but today Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov gave an address where he defended his country's actions.
We were waiting for steps to be taken against impunity in Ukraine, and we don't expect anything more from this institution or a whole range of other international institutions. Everything I've said today simply confirms that the decision to conduct the special military operation was inevitable.
In Ukraine, there's been cautious celebration after a prisoner exchange saw more than 200 prisoners of war released by Russia. It includes more than 100 fighters from the Azov Steelworks in Mariupol, while 55 Russians were released. This is Isabella Higgins in London, reporting for AM.
Australian news website Crikey says it's important the rich and powerful can be critiqued. The independent publisher's preparing to defend itself in a defamation battle with News Corp co-chairman Lachlan Murdoch. If the matter goes to trial, it could be the first to test a new defence in Australia's defamation laws. Isabel Massali reports.
Ever since Crikey took out an ad in the New York Times in August challenging Lachlan Murdoch to sue it, it was clear this would be a very public battle. Now with the defamation case launched, Crikey isn't backing down.
Since we first went public, our intention has been to show how the rich and powerful use defamation law in Australia. So we wanted to briefly explain the key points of our defence and where we go from here.
Will Hayward is the CEO of Private Media, which owns Crikey. In a social media video, he's outlined the three elements that'll form Crikey's defence, including a denial that they defamed Fox CEO Lachlan Murdoch, along with a claim that he didn't suffer any serious harm. And
we don't think journalists should be prevented by law from expressing honestly held opinions on matters of huge public interest. It is the opinion of this paper and its journalists that Fox News actively supported and promoted a concerted attempt to jeopardise American democracy. Now, we can understand that someone might disagree with us, but we think it's a reasonable argument to make.
I think that this matter is unlikely to be decided mainly on the law. I think it will be decided on the politics.
That's freelance journalist and journalism academic Dr. Margaret Simons, who in the past has written for Crikey.
The word in the Crikey article, which went a little bit beyond what others have said was co-conspirator. I think it's inarguable, really, that the Fox News network, which Murdoch owns, was amplifying some of Trump's messages and the messages of people who stormed the Capitol. I think that's beyond dispute, really. But, you know, it's a step further to describe them as conspirators, which suggests, you know, a degree of collusion and deliberation.
As for how Crikey plans to defend itself, she believes there are no surprises here. Dr. Matt Collins, KC, agrees. He's the president of the Australian Bar Association and specialises in media law. He says it's difficult to tell how strong Crikey's defence will be, but believes it'll be interesting to see Australia's new defamation law amendments in action.
One of the key changes was the introduction of a new defence, which is intended to protect investigative journalism in respect of subjects of public interest. Now, it might be argued that Bernard Keane's article in Crikey does not fall within that description. It was essentially an opinion piece. The defence is intended to operate to provide publishers with protection for the publication of false facts where they reasonably believe that their publication was in the public interest.
Crikey says they've handed this matter over to the courts and now they plan to remain silent. There'll be a preliminary hearing in the federal court today.
Isabel Massali reporting. Graziers, traditional owners and lobby groups are welcoming Origin Energy's decision to walk away from gas exploration projects in Queensland's Lake Eyre Basin, Western Australia and the Northern Territory. The company says it wants to focus on the clean energy transition. But in the heart of outback Queensland, locals say the fight to end fracking in the fragile river system is just starting. Victoria Pengilly filed this report from Junda. In Queensland's Channel Country, grazier Kerry Pidgeon and her husband Ken Griffiths are checking creek levels on their sprawling cattle station. It's one of the last remaining free-flowing desert river systems in the world. But for several years, the graziers have been fighting unconventional gas exploration or fracking.
To me, it's one of the great wonders of the world to see, you know, any fracking or any development on the floodouts of the Thompson and the Cooper is ridiculous.
News this week that Origin is abandoning its ambitions in the region might have been welcomed. The graziers, like Kerry Pidgeon, believe the fight is far from over.
It's not stopping industry or it's not stopping anything from happening at all. It's just a change of the reins, so to speak, and it's just going to continue.
The gas giant says it plans to exit almost all exploration projects across Australia to focus on the energy transition. It means Origin will now either sell its permits to another company or forfeit them back to the state government.
Mulligan's Lake, just back there.
In the tiny town of Windora, Mithika elder George Gorringe is sceptical of the decision.
I don't see how it's going to change anything, just that we've got a different mob to deal with, so I don't know what this next mob's going to be like.
For several months, the traditional owner has led discussions with the state government pushing for better protection of his home. Until this week, he was hopeful there would be a positive outcome. Now he's not so sure.
It's going to be a bit harder, I think, for a while. But at the same time, I think it's a good opportunity for government to step in and say, well, no fracking on the floodplain and no infrastructure.
Origin Energy has told the ABC it will now focus on reviewing its existing permit sites. The Department of Resources says the Palaszczuk government will have little to do with the process. Ellen Roberts from environmental group Lock the Gate is worried incoming energy groups could use cowboy tactics.
Origin is a very big player. They're a very well-resourced company. Smaller companies will have a much harder time getting these projects off the ground. But there's also a risk of these smaller companies exhibiting cowboy-type behaviour.
Back in Junda, grazier Ken Griffiths has little faith energy companies or the state government will protect his home.
Look, I can still remember the times when we were mustering, and what a beautiful thing to be out of, yep, doing hard days work in the mustering camp, and we'd ride our horses into those big water holes and put your quart pot down, get a lovely, cool drink of water. I wouldn't like to be doing that if there's a lot of fracking happening on the Channel Country.
Grazier, Ken Griffiths, ending that report from Victoria Pengilly, and that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
Vladimir Putin's threatened the world with nuclear war and is scrambling to re-enlist thousands of former soldiers to boost his ailing forces. Today, retired US Army Major John Spencer on whether the Russian leader is bluffing and the consequences for the world if he's not. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.